swearing on for the cabinet that I'll ask the president to dissolve the 32nd Dáil. I've always said that the election should happen at the best time for the country. Now is that time.
And therefore, if that is achieved, that you do have the possibility of creating greater growth in the society and creating better jobs.
Are we certain that we actually have the critical mass of public infrastructure and public service capacity to ensure that we can keep this golden goose that we have and that we can actually be the family that makes future generations better off?
Business at the ballot box. Be the voice.
And welcome back to Business at the Ballot Box, a special general election podcast series brought to you by IBEC, the voice of Irish business. Every day between now and February 8th, we're exploring the issues that matter most to you and your workforce, and also hearing directly from Ireland's business leaders about what the government needs to prioritise to help business, and in turn society, reach their full potential. I'm Patrick Haughey, and in today's episode, I will be meeting three people with a lot to say on the critical issues of childcare and elder care, each of them coming from a very different perspective. We hear a personal story of trying to organise care for a parent. We look at what businesses can do and are doing to facilitate parents in the workforce, as well as encouraging more parents to join the workforce. And we put forward some visionary, innovative solutions for improving these major societal challenges. So without further ado, let's meet today's guests.
IBEC, the voice of Irish business.
And I am delighted to be joined now by Cara McGann, Head of Social Policy at IBEC, Anne O'Leary, CEO of Vodafone Ireland, and Brendan Courtney, broadcaster, designer, founder of Lennon Courtney, and self-described optimistic crusader on your Twitter. Is that can we use that title today, Brendan?
I've met a few crusaders recently who've used the handle on their social media. So you're also a crusader. Optimistic crusader would be... just to put a positive spin on my tweets.
Well, I love it because God knows we need optimism and we need crusading in society and in business right now in many cases. So delighted to have an optimistic crusader on the panel. But we are going to start with yourself, Cara, to set the scene. So I suppose looking at some of the facts and figures you took me through before we opened the microphones here, it seems that Ireland's record in child and elder care is a particularly poor one. And the knock-on effects on business and employee quality of life is pretty stark. Now, this podcast is about focusing on the positives, on the vision, on the solutions in this discussion. But let's get those nasty statistics out of the way. Let's set the scene before we sort of launch into what can be done. Do you want to take us through some of the things we should know about the situation right now?
Certainly. We've seen that despite significant investment in both child and elder care, it's not meeting the needs of individuals or families, businesses, society, employees or employers. And based on demographics, that situation's only going to get worse. We have on average, one of the highest costs of childcare in the OECD, with an average cost of about 53.5% of the average wage compared to 27.6% elsewhere in the OECD. Our record, if you like, around childcare and elder care supports, we have one of the worst track records again in Europe. So we're second out of 11 European countries for unmet needs in terms of home care services. We're fourth out of 11 for unmet needs in terms of childcare services. And these are components that connect to quality of life, to the ability to fully participate in the labour market, to avoid poverty and social exclusion and so on. And as I say, with demographics and the way the demographics are going, we know the situation is going to become worse. So if we don't get a handle on this urgently, we are looking at probably an emerging crisis situation. Although I imagine if you're the individual who's trying to navigate through the care system to find supports for your loved one who's older or sick or trying to come out of hospital, or you're the parent who's trying to find a quality, affordable place for your baby so that you can return to work, it may already feel like a crisis.
Absolutely. And so I think we'll focus on childcare first, okay, and we'll focus on elder care then just in a few minutes' time. In terms of childcare, can you give us any examples or any anecdotes in relation to the practicalities of this, what it looks like for an individual or for a business facing this stark situation?
Well, we're hearing from employers about a number of women who aren't in a position to return following maternity leave because they're unable to get a place for their baby. So the under three category has become quite a kind of an endangered species in many childcare services, because with funding structures and fee structures, we're losing that particular cohort of beds and places within childcare services. They're more expensive, more labour intensive, and the regulations have increased in these areas. And as a result, they're not as attractive to providers. And this has a huge knock-on effect to labour market participation. So it's not helping families, it's not helping business, it's not helping society. And it's a major concern, particularly for women.
And we certainly need more people in the workforce participating in the labour market right now, given where the economy's at. And Anne O'Leary, CEO of Vodafone Ireland, obviously you're a very large and significant employer in Ireland. How many people would be on your team?
We employ 2,000 people in Ireland. So obviously access to talent and having the best talent is key for us. And also gender diversity is key for us as well. So this focus on childcare is very important, because we not only want a 50-50 gender split, we want to ensure that people that choose to have children and families can continue to participate in the workforce. So, you know, we can talk about what we'd like government to do, but I suppose we've done a lot from an employee perspective as well to support families and both fathers and mothers. And I know as an employers, a lot of people talk to us about that and a lot of people have followed. So I suppose the first thing is flexible work hours. And that's really important for mummies and daddies, that was start times and finish times. You know, we try not to have meetings before 9 or after 5. So it's kind of a culture of respect for people with kids, and that both parents want to be involved. Of course, we have a very good maternity leave policy. So women get fully paid for 6 months. They then take holiday time, and then they have what we call a ramp on. So for the first 6 months when they return from maternity leave, they work 4 days, get paid 5 days. And what we've looked at is that 90% of women that take maternity leave in Vodafone return and stay an average of 9 years. So the investment in a really world-class maternity leave policy means that women continue to work and stay with us. So we keep the experience, we keep the knowledge. And more recently, which I think is kind of groundbreaking, is we launched our paternity leave policy. So this is for all non-birthing parents. So it can be through adoption and surrogacy as well. Each will get 16 weeks fully paid following the birth of a child in the first 18 months. And they also have the ramp on. So they work 4 days and get paid 5 days. And this really is about focusing on the family and the role of men and women, or fathers and mothers, in bringing up children.
And that word fully paid is very key here, because we have seen the government making very strong efforts to introduce, and I'm going to stick with I suppose paternal leave, is that the word?
Paternity
leave. But what we saw is the take up wasn't so great because it's state benefit. So maybe the father, the family can't afford to take that leave much as they'd like to.
Well, I think so. Just the feedback that we got from employees is, why weren't the fathers taking up the paternity leave? And it was for the financial implications. And then in terms of having children, women were worried about the negative career implications. So putting off having children, or really worried about when they should have them. And we see our lowering birth rate in Ireland and our growing ageing population. And I really think we need to have a society that encourages people to have children if they want to, and that it's not financial or career implications are going to hold them back.
I think there's other implications around men not taking a paternity leave as well, and I think it's attitude as well to that, because there's a couple of statistics I've read about attitude towards men taking a paternity leave, and I think that's a cultural shift as well that has to happen. But my media wife Sonia Lennon is on the gender pay gap workforce and would be much more aware of the issues around this. And I feel if you go, the tip of the iceberg is the actual, just the pay gap. And underneath the surface then are all the issues that are causing gender inequality in the workplace, and childcare being one particular issue that needs to be addressed in order for men and women to thrive in the workplace. So I actually think that the current task force towards addressing gender pay gap will sort of flush all these issues out, and whether how we deal with them now is the next thing. But once they're flushed out, I feel that we're making positive strides. I mean, I have to say, Vodafone's policy is super impressive, and I didn't realise it was that good, and that is impressive. So more people should be taken. I mean, that's a great place to start even, but it does cost money, as you say.
Yeah. And I guess that, but that investment, and just to come back to yourself for a second, Anne, that investment, if you can afford to make it, is probably, it sees a really, really significant return. First of all, as you said, women are coming back and working for an average of 9 years. But also, when those parents, both the fathers and the mums, are taking that leave, is this an opportunity to develop other staff into the role and bring them on internally?
Yeah, and I think that's a very good point, because often people just look at the cost and they don't look at the return on the investment, because having a high turnover of staff, I mean, it's hard to get good people. It's hard to keep people in Ireland now. Employees have a choice to leave. So we have looked at it and we can see the retention of key experience and expertise. We don't have to pay recruitment fees for new people. We don't have to train them in. But you're right, there's opportunities for people to step up, take a stretch role, take an interim role, learn new skills and do new things as well. So I think you have to look at the business case end to end. You know, if there was no return, we wouldn't really do it. There is a positive return. We get more engagement, we get more loyalty, we get people more committed, going that extra mile. And I think if you have all your employees doing that, you'll get better business results. And, you know, as a big business, we do have to look at the societal impact of what we do, you know, and I think more businesses are not just looking at profit and return, but looking at what is our role in the society nowadays. So whether it's diversity and inclusion, whether it's around the planet, whether it's doing good. But I believe if you do those good things, which are good for the economy, which is good for society, which is good for Ireland, you will get good business results, because people will be, when they make choices about decisions about what brand I'm going to go with, you'd like them to think about, I want to go for a brand that really cares about Ireland, cares about people, cares about family, isn't just talking about it, but walking the talk as well. So we also have like term time holidays, so people can take, you know, holiday time off, like the month of August off or Christmas time off. Now, some of that can be unpaid, but they have the ability to say, I can get my work done. I can take 4 weeks off for August, spend time when they're on holidays, which I will, and I'll hand it to my team or I'll get someone else to do it. So really having, understanding that each person or employee has different needs, and whether it's young families or elderly parents, or, you know, there's a life cycle that an employee have, and we have to adapt our policies and our culture to be sensitive to that, and to understand that the business can still work while supporting the needs of the employees through that life cycle.
Cara, so let's look at some solutions here. Let's look at, as you say, the government has spent money on this. Maybe it's not the same amount of money that other countries are spending, and we can certainly learn from that. But beyond that investment, what are some of the things that through your research and through listening to members and members' concerns, what are some of the things that you believe the next government can look at and business and society can look at in order to try and get us to a better place here?
Well, I think Anne hit the nail on the head. You know, we have to recognise that people don't leave the, you know, parts of themselves at the door as they're coming into work. And that holistic idea of, you know, people bringing their whole selves to work is really, really important. But to facilitate them doing that, we need to see really, I suppose, innovative investment. Not just investing into the whole area, but actually looking at the funding models, looking at how we look after staffing, where the funding is actually going, you know, where the regulations are in place, that there's no unintended consequences. We've seen, for example, great uptake of the early childhood care and education, or what's typically known as the free preschool year. But some of the unintended consequences that we hear from providers is that providers, to try and bring down costs in other areas, have really started to focus only on ECHE services, which is a great service, really, really positive. But it means that we're missing out on other parts of this, of that, through no intention, but that's the result.
Well, we've got a planned strike from a lot of childcare providers next week, and it's down to that thing that, and it really brings up that point, low pay is really affecting that particular industry, the provider side of stuff. So if we're paying so much for childcare, and but the childcare providers feel so poorly paid, what's happening? What's happening in the middle?
We have a lot, I suppose. We reckon it's about 70% is going on staff costs. And as you say, we still have a problem in that area. So it just shows the level of investment that we really have to see coming into that whole sector. But also in terms of how we approach the whole area, so that we're achieving quality, but that we're also achieving the right capitation levels, and that we have engagement between employees, employers, and the parents and families, to make sure that everybody, all the stakeholders, are actually winning in this scenario. Because as you say, at the moment, it appears nobody is coming out with a great service or a great outcome from this as it stands. We also need to see things, for example, really small, tangible things that would have a huge impact, like abolishing the commercial rates for early childhood care and learning services. So some of them are already exempt by virtue of the land that they're on, or the particular structure that they are, you know, whether they're a particular community setting or they only run the ECHE services, but others aren't. So for example, we looked at the comparison between the highest fee paying area, which is Dunleary, and the lowest, which is Carlow. But when you actually examine their commercial rates, they're more than double in Dunleary compared. So we're not comparing like with like. So we get this narrative out there, but actually in reality, it's too simplistic. We have to look under the hood of it to really see what's actually going on. So we need to really look at that funding model, and that's already in the first five strategies. So we really need to see that implemented in a way that's actually going to benefit all of the stakeholders in this area. And as Anne has said, employers have a role to play too. And that piece of flexibility and you know, ensuring that people can manage their work and their non-work lives to make this work is really, really positive.
Okay, so let's move on to elder care, because a hugely significant discussion, Brendan. So, and that's why I'd like to start with you, because you really have had a whirlwind few years from when you produced and presented that fantastic documentary about your father, then about your mother. And really since then, you have become extremely involved in this whole area. Could you just remind us about that very first documentary and the story behind it?
So Dad had his first stroke in 2015. And then we went through the process and he walked out of hospital 10 weeks later. And I suppose the really weird thing was, we were warned by, you know, all his medical team that it very likely would strike again. But Dad walked out of hospital. Mum was fine. They were early in their early 70s. So they were both working. Mum was working full time. And they didn't build a bathroom downstairs. And my dad's a builder. So it was very strange. And literally to the day he dropped and had a profound stroke and left him completely paralysed. And with my frustration trying to navigate the Fair Deal scheme and being a TV producer for many years, it occurred that we should film this maybe. My father always shied away from my public life. And when I said it to him jokingly, he said, "I think it's a great idea. Let's make a documentary." So personally, we had this incredible journey with my father where we filmed him for a year. And I got to spend intense and beautiful time with him before he passed away. But I suppose publicly, we sort of lifted the lid off, a lid that was coming off in terms of how families were feeling about Fair Deal, how unfair it was. And I suppose the crux of it all was, we discovered we wanted to bring our father home. We needed to access money, and we wanted to use the Fair Deal scheme, which on paper I thought, well, this is quite a good idea for someone like me. When I'm older, I can use my house to access care, but we could only use it for nursing home care. So not to get into the politics of where that was driven from, but, you know, nursing homes were built and they were tax exempt and all this nonsense. Anyway, it seemed ludicrous now that we had all these private home care services that we couldn't access with the same money, but we could give it to a private nursing home. And it resonated with a lot of families. And I didn't even realise it would resonate so heavily and deeply with families. So we aired the documentary, and that was in the January of 2017, and it was a wonderful experience for my family, to be honest. People are often say to me it must have been a very difficult thing to do because it's a personal thing, but we were going through it, and putting a camera on it was not really a stretch when you're going through something quite harrowing with the family. And it made my whole family go, oh, the crews are coming, and they fix their ties and put their lipstick on. So it was this kind of distraction from the whole thing. Anyway, Dad became quite the celebrity in the hospice, and it was a beautiful time for my family. Unfortunately, then Dad passed away in the June of 2017, yes. And then we made another film about Mum, and she didn't like the idea of, we need to talk about Mum. My mother's still very vital, young working woman, and she's in her mid 70s now. And she said, can we call it Dealing with Grief and Moving On? And I was like, brilliant idea. But actually, that's what it was about. It was about what was she going to do next. She lived in a four-bedroom house. She couldn't downsize. And interestingly, to jump straight ahead, I'm now on the implementation board for Sláinte Care, appointed by the Minister for Health. And we can have our opinions about that, but it's an interesting time. But also now I'm going to be working with the cross-party committee, which is across health and housing, where the big piece of thinking that hasn't been, I suppose, figured out is how do older people living in big houses downsize? And there's no planning, there's no options, they can't release assets from the fund, so they're technically like, you know, the classic story of the farmer on the 100 acres, but he's old and he can't farm it, but he's got this asset and no money. And we're seeing that in middle class Ireland, or, you know, working class Ireland now. So in a way, there's a big piece of the puzzle needs to be figured out.
So from your time on those boards and on those committees, what would you say are the sort of the one or two really, really pressing things that need to be looked at by the next government?
They're the same as when I made the documentary. I suppose I didn't want to stand outside Dáil Éireann throwing bricks in the window unless I understood, because actually I'm a commercially minded person. I run a business, and if there's no money, it can't happen, right? So where is the money going? So I did a lot of research, and actually I spent time at Roisin Shortall, who started the initiative of Sláinte Care, got in a cross-party agreement on Sláinte Care, and was the person who drove it. Just gave me access to all the files I needed to understand where and how the money is moved around in terms of healthcare, particularly around home care services. And my three things were, first of all, and I say it every year around budget time, every year the government, in terms of care, just plans to fail. They don't address the waiting list, which is doubling year on year nearly. It's gone from 4,000 when I did the documentary to nearly 7,500 people on a waiting list for home care approved by the HSC, sitting at home. 22% of those people can't even take their own medication and they're not getting home care. So address that waiting list. That's an emergency as far as I'm concerned. The second thing is obviously break open home fair deal for home care. Split it. Now, what they've done, in fairness to them, they have developed two systems. There's now still a fair deal for nursing home care, and there will be a fair deal for home care, because they are slightly different in that you're caring for people in your own home and it has implications for insurance, and they just had to legally riddle that out. That's being piloted, I'm being told, by the Minister's office. I just text this morning, where are we at with that? It is being piloted by a number of families to see the scheme works, because actually they rushed fair deal for nursing home care through the last time and they obviously made mistakes, so they want to get it right. And then the third thing that I feel we should all be striving for is a statutory right to home care for everybody over 70. I really think that we can afford it. I think if we, you know, sort out how we're spending in healthcare in general, that a statutory right to home care for people who pay taxes all their lives should be, I think it's not an unreasonable ask in about 8 or 9 years in this country.
Cara, from the research you've done, did this all tally?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, by 2030, we know that 1 in 5 people will be a family carer. The number of people who will be 65 years old is going to increase by 50% by 2046, and people are easily living into their 80s and 90s. We're kind of a product of our own success in a way, which is a great thing. But it does mean that we have this coming down the track at us, this particular issue around elder care. And as you rightly said, Brendan, you know, we already have a waiting list. So even with the investment that has gone in, and it has been good, it's not hitting the mark. So we know that there's 355,000 family carers who are providing 16 million hours of care every year, unpaid. Now, many of them might not even see themselves as carers per se, but as mums, dads, or you know, daughters and sons. But 1 in 9 of those family carers are in employment. So they're the ones trying to juggle everything. And then if they're in the sandwich generation, they may have childcare as well as elder care, you know, adding to the situation. But exactly to your point, Brendan, we know that if we had a 10% increase in home care per capita, we'd see 40,000 fewer inpatient beds in hospitals nationally. Wow. So you know, there's so many
areas. That's a heartbreaking
point.
I remember hearing the term bed blocker. Yeah. And I remember being in these meetings and the social care worker came in, who no longer works in Tala Hospital, so it's okay, and came in, and then a really nice guy, by the way, and a social worker trying to explain fair deal to us, and it's an accountancy package, and I studied accountancy, so and my mum's going, what's going on, and my dad sitting in a wheelchair, and it was all crazy. And then in comes head of beds, and her job was to get us out. you need to take him home, you need to take him home. Yeah. And I rang our local TD and said, what will I do? And he said, do not take your father until you're happy with the care package you're getting. So you start this fight at this very traumatic time. Yes. But the term bed blocker really shocked me, because there was no community-based care for us to take our father out of essentially an emergency ward.
And there appears to be a waiting list before assessment, following assessment, as you say, people who have been approved, but the hours, the carers just aren't there. Similarly, we hear from the providers that sometimes the assessment isn't consistent depending on where you're assessed. So somebody with one particular set of circumstances might be approved for 12 hours, somebody in the exact same set of circumstances might be approved for 20 hours, and yet we're still struggling to fill those hours. So it is quite a complicated area, and one that we really need to see the joined up thinking, that whole approach, which under Sláinte Care hopefully we will see, where we get that structure in place, we get a standardised assessment model, we get, you know, the regulation within the system, and we get that statutory right for home care.
And I guess with a workforce of 2,000 people, the issues that you see around childcare, I'm sure, are the same as you see maybe around elder care as well. People looking for flexible work options to look after their parents or whatever that requires.
Well, I suppose if I stand back from it, I think the most vulnerable in society are the young and the old. So if you think about that, we need to make sure there's investment in early childhood, proper qualified people that can look after our children, which will set us up for the future. And the same in elder care. I mean, my mother was looked after at home for 10 years and then ended out in a home for the last 10 years. So I know well what it's like. She passed away 2 years ago. And I think as a country, we haven't invested in enough, and we need, you know, qualified, you know, early child minders that are registered and qualified, same as elderly care, that can be paid well and fairly, that, because these are tough roles. So because we're hearing about early care, that they don't stay in it long because they're paid so poorly, and it's, you know, they're with children all day or with elderly people. So I think we need to think about the training around them, the regulation around it, the qualification around it, the incentives to do it, the pay that they get for it. And we know in other countries like France, they're like, it's like qualified nurses. It's our nursing and teaching. And I think what we are seeing is we've more people in employment than ever before. I think about 2 million people. And there's still only around 300,000 state, you know, nurses, teachers and that. So as a country, we need to question, do we need another 100,000 childcare workers and elder care workers who are subsidised, paid, qualified and regulated? And then, you know, tax incentives and subsidies to go with that. So I really think as a nation, this is something, and I think all employers like myself would support that. We can do our bit, but there needs to be state infrastructure. And I've often talked about our schools. These were built by the state with taxpayers' money. They're lying idle a lot of the time during holidays and for maybe half two in the day. You know, people could go in and mind the kids there and look after them. Also, there's, you know, people that have two or three kids, they're dropping one to creche, one to school, then going back to the creche, the collecting, dropping. You know, these things. And, you know, people come in and say, I just can't do it. You know, this, you know, between one and six, I have three children and it's just too much. They're stepping out of work. We're losing. They're highly educated. We're losing that talent. And then trying to get back in for them can be tough again. And we have a returners to work policy that we try and do. So really, from a governmental perspective and an Irish perspective, we need to think about the very young and the very old. How much are we going to invest? What do we expect from our state? How can we use the infrastructure that's already there? Are there government-owned buildings and community centres? I mean, we know in France is one of the best childcare, and it's done by the county councils in the local areas, and they use the schools and they use the facilities that are open 11, 12 hours a day, where there's proper nutrition, there's proper sporting. And I know my own nephews go in, it's in their school, and they're learning chess, they're learning soccer. You know, everyone, the kids want to be part of it. They don't actually want to go home at half two. And this isn't about undermining parents that decide they want to stay at home. That is fine. I totally respect that. But what I'm hearing from young men and women is we've been well educated, we want to work, but we want our kids to have the best start in life. So how can we balance that as a country, and what role do we have as employers, but the next government, in terms of really putting in fundamental changes and investment in the right area?
And a way to do that is identifying those over 300,000 people who are care workers at home, unpaid. I think you got those figures probably from the Human Rights and Equality Commission, was it?
Family Carers Ireland.
Released these figures. 300,000 people are active carers. And actually, if you start to invest in the carers and start to invest in their well-being and make the job more attractive, give them holiday time, they have great ideas and policies around how you can make it easier or better to be a carer at home and to not shun the responsibility because you're not qualified to do it. I mean, a big part of bringing dad home was we couldn't get him up the stairs, but then it was about having to chairlift him into a toilet. We built the toilet, we tried to scramble to build a bathroom downstairs, we didn't have time unfortunately, but then we'd have to go and train how to hoist him, not hurt him. So it's actually quite a skill based thing to care for somebody in the home as well. So I think grassroots investment from the government, and that's interesting why we're having this conversation today, and who's going to provide that and where does that come from.
And I think it's interesting because it's a moral imperative, a social imperative, yes, and also a business imperative. So for so many reasons, and as you say, it's not undermining anybody's decisions, but it's all about choice and making sure that we have those choices, and to put the structures in place to ensure that the choices are there for people. And then we know it has a knock-on effect for people in employment to stay in employment, to be able to be productive when they're there, to maintain their careers, but also to maintain their health and well-being, because it takes a toll trying to juggle all aspects of your life at the same time, and none of them seem to be going so smoothly. So we need to make sure that we put those structures in place to make sure people can do what they can choose to do, and make sure that, you know, older people who wish to stay in their homes can stay in their homes for as long as possible. You know, that we're getting quality childcare for families, you know, at the way and the places. So it's important that, you know, we not only look at the structures in registered, you know, childcare settings and education settings, but also that we extend that now to the Child Minding Action Plan,
yeah,
to bring more people in underneath that, so that again we're accessing the supports for again choices that families may make around different care choices.
Karen McGann, Head of Social Policy here at IBEC, Anne O'Leary, CEO Vodafone Ireland, and Brendan Courtney, broadcaster, designer, and optimistic crusader.
There
and you
go,
were
yeah,
very optimistic, Brendan. Thank you for bringing that to the table.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much for joining us here at Business at the Ballot Box.
Thank you.
And that's it for this episode of Business at the Ballot Box. Thank you very much to my guests for joining us today, and thank you for listening. If you would like to join the conversation on Twitter and LinkedIn, use the hashtag BeTheVoice. And you can also email us at info@ibec.ie. And of course, make sure to follow or subscribe the series wherever you get your podcasts. In the next episode, Ireland's transport and water infrastructure is beginning to creak at the seams. Economist Colin McCarthy, Derva Cummins of AECOM, and Neil Walker of IBEC propose solutions. And I'll be meeting Caroline Lennon, CEO of AIR. Hope you can join us then.
Business at the Ballot Box. Be the voice.